Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Saturday night was do or die in the U.S. Senate for bringing health care reform legislation to the floor for debate. It lived. Here's Senator Chris Dodd in the glow of a tight, tight vote.
A long road lies ahead of us, but we've begun that journey. And I'm as confident as anything I've ever been before that we are going to accomplish that goal. Before this journey is over, we will have passed national health care coverage for all Americans.
Maybe, maybe not. It's all in play now with stakes high on all sides on cost and coverage, backroom politics, and who will pay. This hour On Point, we're digging into the end game on health care reform. You can join the conversation. Can you see what's coming here? Will it pass? Do you hope so or not? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I want to extend a warm welcome today to listeners at WMFE in Orlando, Florida. It's great to have you with us. Later this hour, we'll look at the Catholic Church in the healthcare debate and the bishop's confrontation with the last of the Kennedy clan in the U.S. Congress. But first today, let's get just the flavor of what went on this weekend on healthcare reform. Here's Saturday night, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, before the vote on Saturday, making the case for the healthcare bill.
This legislation that we're going to vote on a motion proceed to this evening at 8 o'clock saves lives, it saves money, and it saves Medicare. Pretty good deal, I would think.
So he says, but after the vote squeaked through, there was all kinds of criticism. Here's Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Republican, Texas, on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
President Obama said that it would be under $900 billion. It is not. President Obama said it would not add to the deficit. It will. President Obama said that no one would lose the health care that they have, and they will. This is a terrible bill.
And it wasn't just Republicans expressing reservations. Several key Democrats not necessarily on board. Here's Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat, Nebraska, yesterday on ABC's This Week. He's been one of a few key Democrats Senator Reid has had to woo and is especially concerned about the cost of the bill.
It doesn't do enough to control the cost, that's for sure. And we do need to address that cost containment. I'm very concerned about that. But I certainly couldn't say it does nothing.
We're looking at the end game on health care reform this hour, 800-423-8255. You can join us. Joining us first today from Washington is Janet Hook, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She's been covering all the drama around the health care bill. Janet, thanks very much for being with us. Welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Washington, David Cutler, an original architect of President Obama's healthcare push. He's a professor of applied economics at Harvard University and the Kennedy School of Government and author of Your Money or Your Life, Strong Medicine for America's Healthcare System. David Cutler, thank you very much for being here.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, Janet, how did they put together the gang that got it through on Saturday night? And if they got it through Saturday, why doesn't that mean that they could take it right on through to completion, to debate and passage?
Well, they got the 60 votes on Saturday night, sort of the old-fashioned way, one by one, a little bit of horse trading at the end, and an appeal to sort of party unity. Because if all of the Democrats and the two Republicans in the Senate hadn't voted for it, Harry Reid wouldn't have had enough votes to just get the bill on the floor. You have to understand that this is the first of many votes where Harry Reid's going to need 60 votes to keep the bill moving. This, as hard as it was probably the easiest because this was just a vote to bring the bill to the floor, open debate. And now the harder part begins, which is voting on amendments and then ultimately to end the likely Republican filibuster at the end and pass the bill.
We're going to get into those amendments and what may come and what that means for voting numbers. But David Cutler, big picture, how would you handicap the chances of success of this thing actually getting through at this point? After Thanksgiving, they'll be back. The debate will start. There will be a lot of it and horse trading through the roof, I suppose, as Janet says. But what are the odds that this will actually come out the other end as a passed piece of legislation?
Well, I think the odds are looking better than they have, particularly over the summer. And the vote on Saturday, I think, was people's first sense that, yes, there's enough substance here to keep going. What they're going to be trying to decide on is morals and money, morals about the role of government and money about can we afford it and does it save enough money. And if they can convince themselves of that, or at least resolve their differences somehow, I think the odds look very good. But that's not, but it's by no means a sure thing.
Very good, Janet Hook. I don't know. Can you put a number on it? Does it look very likely to you that this thing passes, or still open question?
Well, it depends on what you mean by this thing.
Yeah.
I think it was 100% certain practically. Well, nothing's that certain. I think it's extremely likely that something's going to pass. Whether it's as ambitious and expansive as this or not, that's where the uncertainty comes in. I think if there's one thing that almost all Democrats, if not every Democrat, agrees, it's that their party will really suffer badly if they produce nothing.
We're going to look at the
Republican. I think they're going to pass some bill, mm-hmm. and I think it's going to be pretty close to this ambitious, and it's just a question of how long it takes them to get there.
We'll look at the Republican opposition, where they're pushing back the hardest, but let's look within the Democratic Party first, if you'd help us, Janet, at the four senators on that side of Capitol Hill who have expressed real reservations, not necessarily, I guess, four, that's including Connecticut's now independent Joe Lieberman. But when you look at these four, Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, of course, Ben Nelson, Nebraska, and then Joe Lieberman, do they all have the same objections? Is there a field of objections here? Can they be brought on board without losing other votes that are needed to put it through?
Well, that's the ultimate question. I think there's a lot in common with the reservations that the four have. One you've already mentioned, which is that the question of whether the bill goes far enough to control health care costs. Really, the legislation has two very large aims. One is to control health care costs, and the other is to expand health insurance coverage to the millions that are uninsured now. And other Democrats have put more emphasis on the expanding coverage. Mm. These are Democrats who really want to do more to save money. And then the other concern that they all share is concern about the public option, the idea of having a government-run insurance option available for people who don't get insurance through their employer. And there are a wide variety of compromises on that front that are out there. And I think there should be a formula at the end that could bring everybody on board. It's not exactly clear now what that will be.
David Cutler, we heard Ben Nelson at the top of the hour saying he's skeptical about controlling costs with this legislation. What is being asserted now in terms of what the cost savings would be, or at least the reduced deficit case that's being made here? And you know, do you see this as an effective break or at least clutch on cost control in healthcare in this country or not?
The tricky thing, in terms of what's being asked for, is that we need to spend more in the short term to cover people, but that over time we need to save money in healthcare, both for our own personal family budgets as well as public, both federal and state and local budgets. I think the legislation goes a long way towards doing that. By no means is it perfect. Nothing is perfect. But it takes a lot of the ideas that have been brewing and turns them into really significant legislation. The biggest reason why there's the kind of perception that it doesn't do enough is because the official congressional scorers say we're not sure it will save much money, so therefore we don't give it any credit for doing that. So you have bills that are trying to do a lot, and in the face of that, they're kind of getting this, well, we're just not going to assert it saves any money for you. That's creating a real, real tension in terms of getting this done.
Janet Hook, that has been a promise from the White House from the beginning, and everybody in the country right now looking at the deficit and wondering how we handle that. I mean, what's the sense you're getting on Capitol Hill? Can people look their constituents square in the eye and say there's going to be savings here, or do they have to look them in the eye and say, no, this is really about covering a lot more Americans, and it's going to cost, you know, it's going to leave us deeper in debt than we'd otherwise be?
Well, you know, there are two kinds of costs that we're talking – well, more than two kinds mm-hmm. of costs that we're talking about, and they often get confused or conflated. Mm-hmm. One is the cost to the government. The other is the concern about controlling the cost of health care per se, which then reflects on how much we pay as patients and how much the government pays for the programs that they subsidize. Mm-hmm. The concern about the deficit and the debt has to do, you know, with the price tag, as David was saying, kind of the overall effect on the deficit and the short-term outlays. The long-term costs and savings are so hard to figure that and politicians tend to deal with the short-term because they're up for re-election and that's where their voters are looking. I do think that one thing that hasn't been remarked on too often is that Obama said from the outset that this effort was going to be paid for, as in, you know, raise taxes and cut spending to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Now, the Republicans dispute the accounting and people argue with the CBO, but they have been kept trying to have the revenues raised match with the amount of outlays. But it's still, no matter whether it's paid for or not, it's a lot of resources going out there, in part because it's a big, expensive problem.
The promise here is that the Senate bill would push down federal deficits by an estimated, $127 billion. I guess that's the Congressional Budget Office number, but do people give that a lot of credence, Janet, or not, when you talk to them on Capitol Hill?
I think, Democrats do and Republicans don't. I think it's kind of viewed in a partisan fashion. I do think that the Republicans, on the one hand, complain that it's not that it's adding to the deficit. On the other hand, they complain about the revenues that are raised to pay for it. This bill does raise taxes in very concrete ways, and if that doesn't, that contributes significantly to reducing the deficit.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the health care reform endgame after a 60-39 Senate squeaker of a vote to start debate, looking at the issues and politics in the final showdown now over health care reform. David Cutler is with us. He teaches economics at Harvard, has been an advisor to President Obama and others on the health care plan. Janet Hook is here, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, been covering the bill front to back, right through this whole process. Very different interpretations of what's going on here from two parties. Here's Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
Millions of American families cannot avoid this important debate about health care. They face it every single day. The Senate shouldn't avoid this debate. I hope in the end that some Republicans will cross over and help us to put together a good bill that will serve this nation.
No Republicans in the Senate doing it yet, but maybe we'll talk about that. Here's Senator Orrin Hatch on Fox on the way into the vote last week.
You know, if you can't get 75 to 80 votes on a bill that affects 1/6 of the American economy, you know it's a lousy bill. And I'm telling you, this is a lousy bill that's going to cost the American taxpayers like mad for the rest of our lives if they happen to pass it. I hope the American people rebel.
The American people rebel, says Orrin Hatch of Utah there. Let's get a call from Steve, Columbia, South Carolina. Steve, you're on the air.
Thanks very much for taking my call, and I say hello to everybody. I'm going to have to basically take my answer off the air because I am getting into town and there's a ton of traffic. And it's
okay.
But very quickly, if the United States is supposed to be positioned as the champion of freedom and democracy, how can we not have a public health care program? How can we not have a program that takes care of all of its citizens, that encompasses the whole bunch? So one, that's number one. And number two, why are those that complain so loudly against it complaining really about, it's a tax burden our children are going to bear? Well, really, it's a tax burden my children are going to bear. It's a tax burden I'm willing for them to bear. And it's a tax burden that really, I can't say all, but the majority of those who complain against it, their children, it's going to be a drop in the bucket. And thanks, I'll take y'all's conversation in the air.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks very much. Janet Hook, what about it? Going into these weeks of debate that are now in front of us, what do the polls show about where Americans stand? You hear where Steve stands. He says, we need coverage for everybody in this country. He's willing to pay for it and have his kids pay for it, too. Is he in the majority at this point? Can we tell?
Well, there are so many different polls and so many different ways of asking the question that I've become sort of baffled myself, and I read them all. Maybe
right,
I read too many.
Right.
I do think that Steve is raising, really the basic question that, you know, for all of these months that Congress has been thinking about it, they haven't answered is, how can we not have a public health care plan? I mean, they're also asking, how can we have a public health care plan? And the obstacles they face there are, we don't have one now, or we have a patchwork of public and private plans for health care. And I think the public is actually sort of baffled by that themselves. I mean, it was interesting that over the summer, when there were all of these public congressional town hall meetings disrupted by people who were upset about Obama's proposals, they said, keep the government out of my Medicare. Well, Medicare is a government program. And so I think that's part of why I think public opinion polls show so much confusion about whether they're supporting this or not. The tendency is the public is supportive of changing the healthcare system because they're unhappy with parts of it. And they're not so sure whether they want this particular legislation or other.
David Cutler, look at the public option piece of this for a minute. Of course, you've got Democrats who say if there isn't a public option in the final bill, they won't vote for it. And you've got others who say they won't vote for it if there is one there. How do you see the count playing out around that issue at this point, David?
They clearly need to come up with some compromise on the public option. I think it's unlikely to be as robust as in the House bill, but there is much more exploration of alternatives in the middle, and I think you're seeing some more of them come out. I think just to come back to what Steve's comment is, which was exactly right, we are passing on, if we do nothing, an enormous liability to our children and grandchildren. And really the only way we can afford government and the existing healthcare obligations is by changing the system to make it work better. And that's what this legislation is trying to do, is change the system to make it work better. Nobody knows what will be most successful, but those who don't want to try really you wouldn't want to say the status quo is acceptable in any way.
Janet, let's talk about that public option piece for a moment. You've got senators like Bernie Sanders in Vermont, Sherrod Brown, Ohio, you know, saying they won't vote for it unless it's in there. And we heard at the top of the hour, Ben Nelson and others aren't so sure on that front. How do you see that shaking down as we go into the weeks of debate here, Janet?
Well, as David was saying, there are lots of alternatives. And I think probably what we'll see during the Senate floor debate is amendments that offer alternatives, you know, alternatives like Senator Snowe's idea of having a public option, but only as a fallback, which is to say, if the private insurance market doesn't produce enough policies that are affordable by some measure that would have to be determined in the law, that a public option would trigger in. That's one possibility. And then there's another approach, which is to have a public option only if states actively opt into it. Right now, they establish a public option and states can choose to drop out or not offer it. There's that. And, you know, in the end, whatever comes out of the Senate, it's going to have to be kind of renegotiated all over again when the House and Senate meet in a conference. Because the House bill has a stronger version of the public option with none of this option to not offer it.
Let's talk about who's going to pay for this. There's another area where Senate and House go in different directions. Where does that stand now? How would the Senate bill, where would they raise revenue to pay for this? What about House? What's the gap between the two?
Well, the Senate bill has a variety of funding sources. The ones that apply most directly to individuals, or that is easiest to calculate what the effect is the first one is a relatively new element, which is raising the payroll tax that people pay into Medicare, but only for people in the upper income brackets. It would be a very small increase, but an increase indeed from 1.45% to 1.95%, but only for individuals making more than $200,000 or families with a $250,000 income. There's that. Then there's a tax on very expensive health insurance plans. If you have, they call it the Cadillac tax. And that was scaled back a little bit because of concern that when you say Cadillac, you assume that just means really, really rich people with really fancy health insurance plans. There was concern that it was going to reach into some middle-class plans that happen to be high cost because they live in expensive areas.
Or union-negotiated plans that are pretty good. So the union's been against taxing those plans.
That's right, in general. Because in a lot of cases, unions feel like they have negotiated for their workers lower wages and taken higher benefits to compensate for that.
Let's hear from Mark. Mark in Niagara Falls, New York. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a janitor, and I think that it could pay for itself if the place I work for now offers subsidized health care.
Okay.
If they didn't have to offer that and they wanted to keep me, which I hope they do, they would have to pay me more than some other place that wanted a competent janitor. You know what I'm saying? And if they paid me more, that would put me in a higher tax bracket, and I would pay more taxes, but I'd be happy to.
So up your pay, they subsidize you now. David, take to the extent we can, look at Mark's situation here. He's got a subsidy from his employer. If something along the lines of what's, you know, out there on the rails comes through, does it change a situation or not?
It wouldn't fundamentally change Mark's situation unless, of course, his insurance plan were particularly expensive, as Janet was saying, in which case it would fall into the high-cost tax part. There have been, over time, various proposals to discourage employers from contributing more to health insurance, and thus individual wages would go up. And in fact, if no employer offered health insurance to their employees, the amount of income tax and payroll tax would increase enormously, and you could fund a lot of coverage that way. The difficulty is that it would be a huge relocation for many people. That is, about two-thirds of people are comfortable getting their insurance through their employment, although they're quite worried about it. And if you said, gee, starting on January 1st of next year, your employer is going to stop providing you with health insurance, then the vast bulk of people have no idea where they're going to get it. So what the legislation tries to do is to go slower and say, not let's have employers discontinue their coverage, but rather let's try and build a system alongside the employer system that works well through an exchange. And then over time, we can figure out how to let more people in, let the employers contribute less, have that show up in wages, and get some of that as revenue to the government.
Janet, what about for people who don't have coverage but would be required to get coverage under this? Can you give us a sense of the range of the kind of cash they're going to have to come up with to pay for coverage that would be required if this legislation, some version thereof, goes through?
Well, the for people who don't have any insurance now, that the requirement would come along with subsidies if they can't afford them. So that's why the problem that the legislation is trying to address, it's a very interlocked. On the mm-hmm. one hand, there are all these people who don't have insurance, and some of them don't have insurance because they can't afford it. Some of them don't have insurance because they choose not to, especially sort of younger people who feel like they probably don't need health insurance. So by requiring everyone, virtually everyone, to have insurance, you sort of have to have some form of subsidies. And that's what's very expensive about this bill. And, I don't have the figures right at hand, but the legislation does set a cap on how much any one person in the lower incomes would be required to contribute to their own income. And I think it ranges up to about 12%.
12% of their income?
I better not
David says yes. So, I mean, that's going to be a pretty substantial dollar figure for a lot of families, David.
It is, and that's why the real issue here is, over time, can we reduce the cost of health insurance so that it can become affordable? And what's happened over the past decade, as medical costs have doubled, is that more and more people have been priced out of insurance, and that's happening year after year. One way or the other, this legislation, any legislation, will fall apart if we cannot figure out how to reduce the ongoing increases in medical care costs, because it'll come a point where the government can't deal with it, it can't pass any more of the costs back, it can't pass them on to employers, it can't do anything with them. And so that's why there's this real imperative that people are talking about here, because even in these generous bills, you're still at a point where a lot of middle-income families will be paying 12% of their income for health insurance,
which will get anybody's attention, and the pressure's on from all sides to watch those costs. But we never have succeeded so far in really controlling them. Let's get a call from Memphis, Tennessee. Mark, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Listen, I'm pondering the unemployment numbers in this health care bill with the mandate, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering how is this going to exacerbate the prison overpopulation problem?
What do you mean?
And well, if there's over 10% unemployment, mm-hmm. I don't think American prisons can handle that many people, can they?
What, you mean people are going to have to steal to pay their medical bill, or what are you saying?
If they fail to meet the mandate, they get thrown in prison.
Let's look at it. David Cutler, how about it? I mean, it depends on the size of the subsidy, but it will be. Mark's half facetious there, but only half, I suspect. This will be a real requirement. What happens if people can't or don't pay?
Well, of course, we usually don't throw people in jail for this. What would likely happen the way that we do in Massachusetts is that you have to either have provide proof of coverage or else you pay some financial penalty. And that financial penalty is usually some part of the premium. Of course, as we saw in Massachusetts, once we made insurance be affordable by giving people subsidies for it, and we made it be accessible by creating a place where people could buy it, the vast bulk of people bought before there was any kind of financial penalty. So it's not going to be particularly onerous for the vast bulk of people. I think the general point, though, is that getting insurance has to be something that's easy and feasible for people to do. And when they do that, what we know is that almost everybody would like to have insurance, but they say they can't get it and they can't afford it now.
But if they haven't been paying for it, they haven't had it, but also haven't been paying for it, and suddenly they are and must, that's going to come as a shock to some people, I would think.
For some people, it will be a shock. For the vast bulk of people, what they ought to see is lower premiums over time. Remember, you and I and those of us who are fortunate enough to have insurance are paying now for people who don't have insurance. We're paying in many estimates up to $1,000 a person to pay for the uncompensated care costs of people who don't have coverage. When those people have coverage, there should be an immediate offset in the premiums of everybody who does have coverage.
There's the hope. David Cutler, it's been great having you with us this hour, author of Your Money or Your Life, economics professor at Harvard in the Kennedy School of Government there. Thank you very much for joining us, David.
It's been my pleasure.
Janet Hook, stand by. We're going to come back and look at the abortion issue in the health care reform debate as it heads now into its endgame. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Abortion has ended up right in the middle of the health care reform debate. Under strong pressure from the Catholic Church, the House adopted an amendment banning federal funds from abortion coverage. This weekend, Rhode Island Congressman Patrick Kennedy went public, saying he has been under pressure from his bishop not to take communion because of his stance on abortion. We're going to look at that story and abortion's place in this endgame on health care legislation. For the balance of this hour, you can join the conversation. What do you think? Could the whole health care push still stumble on abortion? And what do you make of a Catholic bishop telling a U.S. Congressman, Patrick Kennedy, not to take communion over abortion? Should the Catholic Church and abortion be in the middle of the health care reform debate? Janet Hook, terrific reporter for the Los Angeles Times, has been with us this hour. She joins us from Washington. We're joined right now as well from Chicago by Scott Appleby, professor of history at Notre Dame and director of the Kroc Institute for International peace studies. Scott, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
How do you look at the role that the Catholic Church is playing in this health care reform debate? They've come out strong for reform, but also been very strong on this abortion issue, which many are saying could still be a real stumbling block on the way to reform. How's the Church looking at what's going on here?
Well, the Church has made abortion the priority for its public engagement on a variety of issues for several years now, and it's become such a priority that it seems to trump even the larger push toward health care reform. Or, to put it this way, health care reform won't go ahead in the minds of the Catholic bishops if the abortion provisions are not in keeping with Catholic teaching. So Patrick Kennedy, to go to that story, mm-hmm. is challenging that linkage between health care reform and this particular abortion provision.
We're going to look at the details of Patrick Kennedy's situation and his back and forth with his bishop there, Thomas Tobin. But Janet, what about the pressure you've seen in Washington from the Catholic Church around this as the House was wrapping up and the amendment that came in there? Remind us what the amendment says.
Well, first, I just want to remind your listeners that it wasn't this debate that established the principle that federal funding isn't used for abortion. Mm-hmm. It's been in place for a long time, so that in Medicaid, the federal state health care program, you can't use the federal money to pay for abortions. The problem is that carrying that principle on in this legislation is a little bit more complicated because it's a whole new program where how you keep federal money from being used for abortion is a little bit more complicated. But the bishops, when the House bill was being passed, the bishops and anti-abortion lawmakers thought that the protections against using federal funding for abortion that were already in the bill as it came to the floor weren't strict enough. So basically, they made it a little bit simpler and a little bit stricter in a way that people think goes beyond what the established policy was, so that for people who get coverage through the public plans, there will be no coverage for abortion, the government options that we call. Also, there's in the exchange, which is the new kind of marketplace for buying health insurance, if you don't get it from your employer, and just remember all of this talks about people who don't get insurance from their employer, those plans essentially wouldn't be able to cover abortion either.
And yet the push back has been very strong here as well, saying, you know, let's not bring this into the health care reform debate on the one hand, and abortion opponents saying, well, we'll draw the line here if it helps stop abortion. Scott Appleby, what came out over the weekend was Patrick Kennedy, I guess it began with him saying that his bishop, Providence Bishop Thomas Tobin, the headline in the newspaper there was Kennedy barred from communion. Goes back to a letter in 2007, so a couple of years ago, but coming out now, I guess because of the pressure around this, because of the health care push. But has this been a pattern across the country of bishops, whether then or more recently, going this pointedly at politicians and saying, you know, it's time now to take a stand against abortion or refrain even from communion, the sacrament?
It's been a recent pattern among a minority of Catholic bishops, but the way I read this conflict between Patrick Kennedy and the Bishop of Providence is that Kennedy is actually trying to pull a kind of role reversal. I believe Kennedy's motivated by his passionate defense of health care reform and his annoyance, not to say anger, at the Catholic bishops for, as he sees it, inserting themselves into the debate around these more tightened restrictions on funding for abortion. Therefore, I think what Kennedy has done is to open a conversation from a couple of years ago that was, by the reporting, a private conversation between Kennedy and Bishop Tobin, his bishop, as a way of kind of provoking the debate and in a sense, marginalizing the Catholic Church's position or stance for taking a position on the health care reform. So, in other words, Kennedy's linking this particular issue of abortion health care with the barring particular Catholic politicians from communion. That is to say, he's making a general complaint against the bishops in a way of pushing them back on the health care matter. So I think actually Kennedy provoked the current headlines himself.
Let's talk with the reporter who broke the story over the weekend. John Mulligan of the Providence Journal joins us from Washington. He's Washington bureau chief there. John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
How did this come to light, and why? Why now?
Well, as to the why, perhaps Scott's speculation is correct, but I'm not sure that it was all that methodical and thought out. There may be some emotion involved on both sides. Congressman Kennedy really spoke first here when he was interviewed in after a speech by a reporter for a very small news outfit who asked him his view about the bishop's position on the medical overhaul bill.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy used some rather strong language to criticize the bishops, and once he did that, Bishop Tobin came back with a strenuous objection to what Kennedy had said. The bishop said specifically, it's not correct that we are opposed to health care, and he especially took issue with Kennedy's having questioned the church's pro-life stance, quote-unquote. Kennedy had said there are the lives of millions of uninsured people at stake.
Mm-hmm.
So Tobin was trying to say, yes, indeed, we want to prohibit taxpayer financing of abortion, but we are defenders of the health care reform movement as well. They've gone back and forth and often using pretty tough language towards each other for several weeks now. Why Kennedy chose on Friday to make the somewhat more explosive disclosure about communion, I can't exactly say, but I do think it's fair to say that both of these men are annoyed at one another.
Everybody's looking for the moral high ground here. What did the letter say that the bishop sent to Patrick Kennedy, congressman, when it comes to the issue of communion and whether or not he should be taking it as a politician who defends a woman's right to abortion?
Well, you get at another point of contention here, Tom. Congressman Kennedy said the bishop instructed me and told me that he was instructing the priests of the diocese not to give me communion. The bishop released only a portion of the letter, but the paragraphs that he released used different language. First of all, the bishop strenuously states that he did not issue any such objection to other priests, and that he made a request, in his words. He asked the congressman to refrain from communion. He then used some language that came directly from what at the time, February 2007, had been a recent pronouncement by the Bishop's Council,
mm-hmm.
sort of an appeal to Catholic conscience, stating that if you repudiate Catholic teaching on these important issues, he meant abortion, of course, then you should refrain from communion. So Tobin's view is that he was passing on church teaching, and Kennedy has not really talked about that until quite recently. Mm-hmm. Kennedy, of course, strongly disputes any idea that this makes him any less of a Catholic, as he put it.
Scott Appleby, do we know of other specific instances in which politicians are now under pressure to refrain from communion, particularly in regard to where they stand on the health care reform legislation?
Well, the history of the bishops refusing communion to Catholic politicians really reached a peak in the 2004 presidential election with candidate John Kerry. And there have been similar episodes since then in which individual bishops have refused communion or suggested that they would refuse communion to Catholic politicians. This has been debated within the bishops' conference, and there was a consensus opinion some years ago. There wasn't a formal report on it, but a consensus opinion that this would not be a policy of the U.S. Catholic bishops as a body, even if they could enforce it on individual bishops, and also a sense that the majority of the bishops, of the more than 300 Catholic bishops, do not support the penalty of refusing communion to Catholic politicians who are in disagreement, particularly on the abortion issue. But there is an important minority of bishops who feel very strongly about this, and so it has been a contentious issue for at least 5 or 6 years. And I think it goes back historically, actually, as far back as 68 and the Church's Pope Paul VI ban on artificial birth control, a reimposition of the traditional ban, which did not stop Catholics from practicing artificial birth control. In fact, there was a spike in the number of Catholics practicing it. That is, there was widespread dissent from that teaching. And ever since that time, I think bishops have grown increasingly frustrated in the Catholic Church in the United States that their teaching on birth control and on abortion and on other matters is routinely ignored by a large segment of the Catholic population. And so Catholic politicians, because they give public scandal, as it were, by openly dissenting from this teaching on abortion, have become the targets for the bishops who find that the way to reassert their authority is to make the communion issue the driving issue.
And now here it is, brought right into the middle of the health care reform debate. And I can't remember the last time the Catholic Church was so prominently and publicly in the middle of such a big and live public policy issue. Let's go to Sharon in Johnston, Iowa. Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi, Patrick. I am strongly opposed to abortion rights. I think that the separation of church and state is at risk in all of this, and I think they're wasting a good legislation time on bigger problems. Every year this comes up. And if we extend this on into the future where different religious groups impose their sanctions on our representatives, then their views are going to control the whole nation as opposed to a minority. A woman has the right to make her own choice, and she has to live with that within her conscience and her own religious beliefs.
So church-state separation, you vote for, Sharon, and we hear it, and I thank you for that call. Let me get one more right here from Concord, Massachusetts. Jan, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello, Jan, you're on.
I wanted to just say a pox on everybody's house to the extent that we're willing to, the right is willing to sacrifice health care, and the left is willing to sacrifice health care, and the needs of 31 million people, all because we want to take those 31 million hostage around this question. I think it is a total distortion on both sides of what the goals are here, which is to ensure people who are otherwise denied access.
What about Catholic leaders who say they have a moral obligation to the unborn here, Jen?
Which obligation should prevail? Is it the 31 million? I really, truly believe that they've been told to heal the sick. That's as much a part of Matthew 25 as anything about the unborn.
Jen, thank you for your call. Janet Hook in Washington, how strong a potential impediment to passage of the health care reform is this at this point? It sort of blew up a few weeks ago. Everybody was suddenly paying attention to it. Is it going to be front and center again before this is all over, Janet?
I don't know if it'll be front and center, but it's going to be. It will have to be addressed at least two more stages. One in the Senate floor, and then in conference. And I think Jan actually, she's very angry about this, but I think she's pointing to the essential question that every member of Congress is going to have to address. Because I guarantee you, however they settle this issue, there are going to be some people who don't like Democrats. I mean, we're mostly just talking about Democrats at this point, since the Republicans are poised to oppose it almost step of the way.
No. Mm-hmm.
So every Democrat has to look at it, whether they're pro-choice or pro-life, and say, I don't like this, but what do I think? Is this more important than the health care bill as a whole? And my instinct is that they'll probably get to some kind of compromise that it'll be hard to say that my opposition to this is so strong that I can't vote for the whole bill.
A lot of House Democrats voted for the package with this amendment saying, well, the Senate will fix this. Will the Senate change it? Is that clear, Janet?
It's not really clear to me. I think probably it will be in the House-Senate conference that the final battle will have to be fought. The Senate, in general, at this stage at least, tends to have the abortion rights majority is stronger than in the House, where there's a larger percentage of Democrats who are anti-abortion.
And John Mulligan, how do you expect the Kennedy and the Bishop back and forth settles down finally? Bishop Tobin, they have to agree to disagree. This is going to simmer right on through the health care debate?
Well, I have thought at several occasions incorrectly that each of them had had enough of this public discussion. So I don't know where these two men are going to find themselves in a few weeks as the debate goes on. But what's interesting is that Patrick Kennedy is unlikely to be an important factor in how the abortion language actually plays out, because he, whatever the bishop's preferences, is strongly on the record in favor of abortion rights, and I believe he's unlikely to change. The difficult votes, the votes that will get a lot of attention on both sides, are among those anti-abortion Democrats, some of whom have supported this tough so-called STUPAC language that passed the House of Representatives, and some of whom have not. So they're going to be on the hot seat.
Watch the swing votes as we head into the heart of the final debate here in the endgame on health care reform. John Mulligan with the Providence Journal, thank you for being with us today, John.
Thank you.
Scott Appleby at Notre Dame, thank you as always for joining us, Scott.
Thank you, Tom.
And Janet Hook with the LA Times, you're terrific. Thanks for joining us, Janet.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.